Hello, everyone. Hope lunch was good. How was it? Jambalaya and gumbo? So thank you all for coming this afternoon. I know I'm really looking forward to the set of presentations we have. I'm sure you are all as well. So we're going to kick this off with a presentation from Mike Casey. Mike is the Associate Director for Recording Services at Indiana University Archives of Traditional Music, and he's the co-chair of the ARSC Technical Committee. He's the co-author of Sound Directions, Best Practices for Audio Preservation, and the developer of FACET, the Field Audio Collection Evaluation Tool. And he's currently working on a year-long media preservation planning project for Indiana University Bloomington, which he's going to talk to us a bit about today, and we'll be hearing contributions from Patrick Feaster as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mike.
Thanks, Chris. Last fall 2009, the Bloomington campus of Indiana University published a report based on a year-long preservation survey of its media collections. This report is available on our website. Find it pretty easily. The report concentrated on audio, video, and film holdings on the Bloomington campus. It's long, 132 pages. I apologize for that. It provides at least a beginning analysis of degradation issues and obsolescence issues by format. It tabulates and analyzes campus holdings, explores a little bit the idea of research value of the holdings, and makes suggestions and ideas for preservation moving forward. Why did we do this? A number of reasons. We knew going in that we had a large number of media objects on campus, but we didn't know exactly how many. We also knew that we had actively experienced degradation with some of the objects, particularly with audio and video recordings, well, film too, to some extent as well, so we had that experience. We also knew that some of the collections were thought to have very high research value. We also have been paying attention to our international colleagues and national colleagues who are telling us that things must be digitally preserved very soon. And we, I think, finally wanted to highlight these problems, bring them into focus for our administration in hopes that we might be able to do something about this problem. So these are some of the kinds of things that we already knew about, delaminating lacquer discs. This is a pretty ugly slide. There's nothing to be had from this disc. We were mindful of our international colleagues who were telling us that, in fact, in the long term, the combination of degradation and obsolescence might prove to be too much to overcome. And also here within our own country, NRPB, suggesting that recorded sound is in peril. And I think we would now change this and no longer say within a few generations, but probably today we would say within a generation, perhaps less for certain formats. Our goal in undertaking this survey was to gather both quantitative and qualitative data on our collections to get accurate numbers, at least at a very basic level, to gather data on the condition and on preservation problems, data on formats so that we can do a deeper obsolescence analysis. And then we wanted to approach this question of why are these holdings important, ultimately to our administration and to others on campus, having some understanding of why this material deserves to be preserved, deserves to have resources we thought would be pretty important. And finally, we wanted to try to collect some stories that would help bring out the ideas of risk and the ideas of research value and the ideas of what we need to do to preserve this over time. We thought first about doing just a standard survey. We ended up not doing that. We thought at first, though, maybe a web-based survey form. That's pretty commonly done these days. And for a number of reasons, we decided against this. First, you get a pretty low response rate. We wanted a response rate of 100%. And so that dictated something other than throwing a survey up on the web and trying to get people to respond to this. We also felt that it would not be accurate enough, that in fact some of the content holders themselves would need some help in identifying the formats they had and certainly some help in understanding what kinds of problems these deteriorating media objects had as well. And then finally, we thought that it would be difficult to solicit this anecdotal information that we wanted if we were just using a web-based survey form. So at this point, I'm going to turn this over to Patrick Feaster, who actually did the survey work, the actual contact with the units, and he will describe the process.
So there was a... Well, thank you. So there was a great deal of legwork involved in this project as I went around and paid a visit to each unit on the campus of Indiana University Bloomington that we had reason to believe had time-based audiovisual media of one sort or another. Beforehand, we'd prepared a set of questions that were designed to be comprehensive enough to give us all the information that we wanted, while also remaining flexible enough so that I could go into more detail about points that emerged in the course of an interview, particularly about issues such as research value, where in some cases a particular unit might not have thought about its collections in that light before, and we might need to do a little bit of discussion or brainstorming to draw out the full potential richness of a collection. In cases of very large collections, units that had very complex holdings, we would share these questions with them in advance, not so that they could simply fill them out, and this would be more of a written questionnaire, but to give them an opportunity to reflect on their holdings, to draw together any paperwork that they might have, any past inventories, counts, and so forth, so that when we sat down to do the interview, they could proceed as efficiently as possible because they'd have all this information right at their fingertips. On the other hand, in the case of smaller collections, I would typically just set up an appointment with whoever seemed to be the best contact person. And in some cases, I suspect this was the first time a particular unit may ever have thought about its audiovisual holdings in a methodical way. In addition to these interviews, I would also conduct an inspection of the collections themselves. And this often would bring out material, information that we otherwise would not have found out about, I'm quite sure. For instance, I might be sitting in the office of the director of a given unit and would look around the room and see a shelf with a row of audio cassettes or videotapes or even a film, would point to this and ask about it. The director might turn around and say, oh, yes, those, I forgot about those. We don't know what those are, let's take a look. Or, in one case, I was looking at a collection that belonged to an area studies unit. As far as we had been able to tell, a standard collection of commercially available material. Looked down towards the floor, there was a little row of hand-labeled video cassettes. I pointed to these, and the response was, oh, those are just, oh, recordings of lectures of people who used to come to the university and talk. Of course, from our standpoint, that was potentially the most important part of the collection that we would not otherwise have found out about. So this is the type of material that we managed to gather from these in-person visits, in addition to more standard issues such as misidentified formats. There was one case in which we'd been told that a collection included many, many CDs, which, when I visited, turned out all to be commercial DVDs. The heart of the interview was a set of questions that we asked about each format that a unit had. We gathered not just overall numbers, but numbers divided into three categories based on the degree to which the preservation of the content depended on the particular item that that unit held. Unique material, defined as literally the only exemplar of its quality. It might be the only copy that existed at all in the world, or it might be a master recording. Commercial material was at the other end of the spectrum. This might be something like a lending library at a residence hall of DVDs, CDs, and so forth. Rare material fell somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. Maybe relatively rare items that had been commercially available at one point, perhaps a field collection that only existed in a few copies as far as we could tell. In addition to those numbers, we gathered information on dates, but also any information about preservation problems either reported by the unit, maybe they had noticed video degradation already occurring, that I could see for myself, say lacquer discs exuding palmitic acid, or cases in which we could anticipate preservation problems, such as tape stocks that are known to display various binder problems. As is already clear, I suspect, the information that we gathered from the interviews was complemented by information from the inspection. These things went hand in hand, but just to be more clear about this, often I would be the person to go through and count the numbers of objects in a collection. And just looking at how these items were stored, are they oriented vertically, horizontally on the shelves? Are there stacks of records on the floor? Is there some effort to control the environment in terms of temperature, humidity, and so on? And then also to document collections with a few photographs. As you can imagine, this gave us a bit of unwieldy information to deal with, ranging from very quantitative number-based data to anecdotes about who had used the collection, why it was important. I had designed a OneNote database that I simply entered information into, raw information, as I was conducting the interviews, inspecting the collections. And we also had an Access database for some of the more quantitative data so that we could then run statistics on the various collections, both the individual collections and then, more excitingly, across the campus as a whole. I'd like to turn it back to Mike to discuss what we found.
Well, what we found is what we suspected, and that is that media collections at this particular point in history have some very critical problems, and I can sum those up by really these four statements. We have large numbers of audio, video, and film objects that are actively degrading, carried on obsolete formats for which we have very little time to do something about. Let's explore each of these in turn as it relates to our collection in Bloomington. We discovered that we had more than 560,000 audio recordings, video recordings, and reels or cores of film. That's a lot of stuff. That's significantly higher than I might have guessed when we embarked upon this this journey. I thought we probably had 300,000, 350,000, something like that, just, you know, ballpark figure as we started out. Turns out we had significantly more than that. You can see the breakdown there by audio, video, and film. And these came from all manner of units across campus, some real surprises, a total of 80-some units. And this was a very orderly process that Patrick went through, as you can see demonstrated by the slide here, to gather this data. But it was just amazing all the different corners of the university where we found materials, and sometimes very important materials. And there's the last one right there, the university archives. Just quickly, some of the places where we found large numbers of items are music library. They have lots of what we might call field recordings, unique recordings, as well as commercial. My own home unit, the Archives of Traditional Music, Media and Reserve Services, Radio and TV Services. Those of you who are from universities might be thinking in terms of your own campus. These are the kinds of places where you can find these kinds of recordings. Language labs. One place where you can often find unique materials. University archives, special collections, libraries, other kinds of archives, and then production units as well. We estimate 44% unique and rare materials on our campus of these 560,000. That's probably higher than many other universities, and I think that's because Indiana started early on collecting with archives in mind, with special collections in mind, and collecting unique items. Top 10 by unique objects, one-of-a-kind items, the music library and the ATM again at the top, radio and TV, university archives, production unit. Athletics departments typically have lots of recordings. Oral history collections, Special Collections Library, and then our Office of University Communications as well. These recordings are carried on some 50-some formats. These are the audio formats here. There are the video formats. There are the film formats. You're getting the idea. Everyone requires a specific playback machine. Everyone requires expertise to know how to get the best play from that playback machine, how to repair it if it's needed. You get the picture. Oldest recording was at the Archives of Traditional Music, 1893, cylinders. Newest, digital files. We spent most of our effort documenting analog recordings and physical digital recordings, not really digital files, although we provide a count of digital files. But I think this is continuing to grow, and this is an area that will continue to grow at our university and is probably a little bit underrepresented in our survey. We also found out some things about our film collection. We knew we had significant holdings of film, but I don't think we understood how significant. David Francis, who was a consultant to the project, has told us that this is probably one of the largest university-based film archives in the United States. and major film collections. Nearly all of these are in the library system at IUB. Returning to our statement from Yaza, taking this idea of degradation and obsolescence and how these forces might combine to make it very difficult to do preservation transfer work, we estimated 180,000 of our items are at high risk for loss of content in the near to midterm. In terms of degradation, we know that there are certain problems with certain formats, and we know a fair bit about some of these. We know how lacquer discs delaminate and what their end game is, for example. We know about open reel tape factors, including sticky shed syndrome, about vinegar syndrome in cellulose acetate film, and to a lesser extent in open reel tape, efflorescence issues with cylinders, cellulose acetate bases wherever they occur, whatever format, fungus, error rates on recordable CDs, half-inch open reel video. This is, fairly well documented problem, color fading in film, pneumatic deterioration, mini DV playback problems. One might reasonably ask, well, do you have this problem within your collections? Do you have these formats and have you seen these problems? Well, we've got the formats. We have over 6,000 lacquer discs, lots of open reel tapes on campus. Most of our film is cellulose acetate, so vinegar syndrome is a real live issue for us. Color film, lots of that as well. Pneumatic. And yes, we have seen some of these problems. This is a lacquer disc that's delaminating. There's another one. There's another one. Open reel tape issues. These are just examples. I could give really 50 more without trying very hard. Fungus issues with open reel tape. The results of videotape degradation, poorly stored film in a unit that shall remain unnamed, but that I know particularly well. Whew, bad. Vinegar syndrome on film. Same thing here. Same thing here. So yeah, we have the formats, we have the problems. That is clear. As part of degradation, we also examined environmental conditions. Because we knew, for example, that temperature and relative humidity are the most important factors in slowing down this physical degradation. So this, to me, became kind of a mathematical equation, if you will. Take this, add to it the fact that we know the room temperature conditions lead to significant damage. This comes from research done by the Image Permanence Institute that's very much available on their website. Add to that the fact that 95% of our holdings are in room temperature conditions. Add the fact that media formats degrade much more rapidly than paper formats do. And for us, this equals the need to store our media in what is known as our auxiliary library facility, which maintains 50 degrees Fahrenheit and 30% relative humidity. This has been a tough nut for us to crack historically, although that's starting to change. But putting our media in a facility like this will help to slow this physical degradation. To take one example, cellulose acetate film. Estimated time before you get serious degradation, assuming the film has not already started to degrade, which is a big assumption, 30 to 40 years. If we put it in the auxiliary library facility conditions, then we're buying some time. We're buying time for preservation strategies to mature so that we can actually do something with all of this film that is undergoing degradation via vinegar syndrome. Let's talk about obsolescence. Just take a quick little break. Come on in. Have a seat. Obsolescence is a very difficult issue that I think we're just now starting to come to grips with. It's not just that the format's going obsolete and that we can't get playback machines. It's the problem of needing spare parts to keep the machines working. It's the problem of having expertise to know how to make those machines get the best playback from a degrading historical recording. It's the expertise needed to repair the machine when it inevitably needs to be serviced, and on and on and on. We know a fair bit about obsolescence. We know, for example, you can no longer get professional-level cassette machines. Open-reel tape machines are very difficult to get these days. Tapes to align those open-reel machines, only made by one company. quad. I don't think there's a working quad in the state of Indiana. I don't know about the neighboring states, but I'm doubtful. 1 inch, I think there's probably only a couple of working 1 inch machines in the state of Indiana. U-matic, format ceased manufacturing in the 90s, although it was dying way before then. Digital audio tape is a huge problem in terms of obsolescence issues. Betacam SP, VHS, you get the idea. All of these formats are headed down that path towards obsolescence. Do we have this problem in our collections? Do we have these formats? Do we have these obsolescence issues? Well, we have lots of open reel tape, so the issues with open reel tape are very live for us. We have lots of cassettes, DATs, VHS tapes, U-matic, Betacam SP. So you get the picture there as well. How much time do we have to provide preservation services for these items? Many archivists feel that we now have about a window of opportunity that stretches from about 15 to 20 years in order to do this work. Less for some formats, like digital audio tape. We have less than that. That lacquer discs, probably less than that. And what happens, the scenario that people envision, is that the combination of degradation and obsolescence advance to the point where it becomes either impossible or just prohibitively expensive to digitally preserve your materials. If we start now. I just came back from Norway, the Joint Technical Symposium, so this is a very appropriate painting by a Norwegian painter for the time. Well, here are some strategies that we're exploring for audio and video. Of course, the recommendation now is to digitally preserve these items. So what percentage of our holdings are digitized? 8%. If we're lucky, many of those have not been done to what we might consider preservation quality or preservation standards. So how long is it going to take us to do this? The Archives of Traditional Music, we ran some numbers. It's going to take us 58 years at our current pace. Music Library ran some numbers. It's going to take them 120 years. We don't have this time. And these are, the Music Library has a full-time audio engineer working at this problem. We have had a full-time audio engineer for about 5 years trying to chip away at this problem. We're not going to make it. We need to do something else, and that needs to happen at from a centralized place from our administration. The key words that we're using for what needs to happen is massive, rapid, and I would add then the word considered. Film's a little bit of a different story. We can stabilize that, as we've seen, via the storage environment, store it in ALF, and that's what we're pushing for, working towards. We've recommended as a strategy to hire a media preservation specialist for the campus that would develop a campus-wide preservation plan, develop strategies for using preservation standards and best practices across the campus, across the university, do the hard work of assessing research value and preservation risk, and then dealing with outsource versus in-house issues in terms of who's going to actually do the work. Write grants. We've also recommended that the campus hire a film archivist to do all of the things that you might expect. The university theater is a state-of-the-art projection facility that's being built right now on our campus. We've also recommended creating a central media preservation and digitization center to do audio preservation transfer, video preservation transfer, and then conservation activities and maybe access digitizing with film. Even with a center like this, how will we get this work done in 15 to 20 years? How do we get to this massive and rapid work that needs to be done? Well, we have some ideas, but at this point, these are just ideas. One is to prioritize. Not everything on our campus is worthy of preservation treatment necessarily. Some things are definitely lower priority than others. So we might use some existing tools, including tools that we've developed, Facet for audio collections, and Rivers, a tool that we're working on now to assess research value and intellectual value of collections. Automate parts of the workflow that machines can do faster. We have some experience in sound directions with automation. Use parallel transfer workflows. Here again, this is simultaneous digitization of multiple sources. Again, we have some experience in sound directions where we're trying to establish some basic principles by which we do parallel transfer work for these kinds of collections. So all of these are strategies. What has happened to date? Campus has hired a film archivist. I think this is partly our doing, but it's partly some other factors on campus that all came together at the right time. So we have a full-time film archivist that started fairly recently, within the last 6 months. All film is now going to be stored in the auxiliary library facility. This is a huge step for us to get the film there. Immediately it's being prepped and gotten ready for the new auxiliary library facility that's being built right now. So this is a great first step. The campus has also funded a year-long planning process to run starting July 1st. This is funded at the highest levels of the campus by the provost's office, by the office of the vice provost for research, by our IT folks, by the library, by the College of Arts and Sciences. And they're putting up a significant amount of money to make this happen. The central goal, there's a lot of goals with this process. The central goals are to create a campus-wide media preservation plan. And this will not be just a statement of principles, although it will certainly include a statement of principles. This will be actual strategies and actual priorities, as in what collections need to be done now, what need to be done in the short term, what need to be done medium term. How can we map this out over a 15 or 20-year period and actually see if we can try to get this done? Our charge is also to plan a central digitization facility to actually begin the massive and rapid work of digitizing our audio and video holdings. So the provost is about to appoint a task force that will be working on this project. The project is buying out half of my time to work on it starting July 1st, half of my boss's time, Alan Burdett, who's the director of the Archives of Traditional Music, and some time from some other staff members as well to work on this project for a year. And they are very serious about this. They have taken the results of this report and really run with it. So this is the process we'll be engaged upon starting July 1st. And I expect that in 6 months to a year, we'll have a lot more to report in terms of what our strategies will be, in terms of what we're going to try to put in place, and hopefully some progress in actually putting these things in place. I said that we had wanted to collect some anecdotal information and some stories to help us bring home the problems that we face, and we were able to do that. I'm going to have Patrick share with you one story that came out of this project. It's not necessarily indicative of the way our collections are stored on campus, but in some ways it really is analogous to the kinds of problems, degradation, obsolescence problems that our collections face.
So I'd like to have you come with me in imagination to the attic of Franklin Hall, a building on the old campus of Indiana University Bloomington that was formerly used as a studio by the artist T.C. Steele, but is now an abandoned machine room. We'd heard through the grapevine that there might be some recordings stored up there that had been discovered fortuitously. Following this up led us to a maintenance inspector in the Office of Risk Management who agreed to take me up there on July 17th of last year, where I found a good deal of debris, fragments of old recording equipment scattered around the floor, bits of paperwork, and sound recordings, mostly 16-inch discs, to which vandals had somehow gained access at some point in the last 10 years or so, with the result that a number of them were bent or had been stomped upon. You can see some footprints there. Thrown across the floor, which was covered with grit, somebody had gone through and at least picked them up and stacked them into stacks about this high, you know, hundreds of discs tall, a number of them glass-based discs. So here's a typical label from this group of recordings. You can see here, Indiana School of Sky, that was a stamp we found on many of them, dates ranging from the late 1940s to the early 50s, and this letter M in red pencil, which we took as an abbreviation, which seems to have been borne out for master. Well, what were these? Turns out the Indiana School of the Sky was a series, an award-winning series of educational radio dramas produced at Indiana University Bloomington beginning in 1947 for K through 12 students, covering topics as diverse as atomic power, Darwin and the theory of evolution, and Greek philosophy and culture, a quite interesting series that, as far as we could tell, only had about seven episodes in circulation among old-time radio collectors. So that's a total of seven known surviving episodes. Perhaps others have seen others. But we had a lot of them, clearly. But clearly some type of massive, rapid, and considered response to this situation was needed in order to try to do something with this group of apparently orphaned recordings. 2 months after the discovery, we set about relocating these to the vaults of the Archives of Traditional Music. This was a fairly involved undertaking. Remember, these are stacked very high. Not only stacked, but also individual discs are covered with grit from the ceiling, and they've been weighted down over however many years with the grit being pressed into the grooves. So one piece of this involved going through, in each case, brushing grit off of the discs, vacuuming them off. After that point, we set them up, numbered each disc, took a photograph of the label so that we'd have some record of what these things were. There was otherwise no documentation whatsoever of what was in this collection. And then packed them into 15-disc groups. Because I haven't mentioned this yet, but to even access the area where these discs were stored, you had to climb up a ladder. It's a vertically mounted metal ladder. There was no other way of even getting to this space. So we had to lift these down in boxes to a place where we could even get them onto dollies to move them to safety. So this is one of the more dramatic cases that we turned up. Certainly not typical, but I'm happy to say that all the discs made it safely to the vault of the Archives of Traditional Music. We have a few recordings that it appears we have time to play.
How's our time doing?
We just had five.
Go ahead, play one.
All right. Are they linked to here?
I don't know if they're there or not.
Do you have it?
On my computer. Mm-hmm. Not there. No, they're not loaded on.
What was your survival rate with all of them?
The survival rate for these recordings?
Yeah.
Well,
we've played only
a few of these so far, but the ones that we've heard to date are they sound terrific, thanks largely to Mark Hood's prodigious cleaning efforts. They've really turned out very nicely. Well, let's move on to questions.
Let's move on to questions. We actually won't know the survival rate until somebody funds us to transfer these. It's a much bigger project than we can handle on the side.
I don't think we will.
Okay, questions. Yes, Andy. I have to summarize the question for the recording. The question was in terms of volumes of material to do, particularly with the DAT format. Have you looked at ways to extract the audio in non-real time, just actually getting the data? We have not yet gone down that path. This will certainly be one piece of many pieces that we'll explore in the task force in terms of how we're going to transfer our DATs. I think there's a lot of good ways to do that in just the ways that you're mentioning, but we have not gone down that path yet. So I have really nothing to offer. Greg?
Yeah, I was curious. You mentioned the digitization center, and based on your description, it sounded like a service site. Maybe it's more than that, but my question is, you've gotten the highest levels of support from the university. You're planning now, but what do you envision, what entity will have the authority and responsibility for prioritizing those what look like 80 different university units' names on that one? It's not just going to be kind of everybody for themselves. It's going to have to some centralized something.
It's a politically charged issue, as you might well imagine. I don't expect that will be an easy thing to do. We will be charged with developing a campus-wide preservation plan, so we'll have a charge that will allow us to at least do a first pass of prioritizing. I expect that to make it into the plan. Beyond that, what we're talking about creating is a larger research center of sorts, possibly located within the library system, that would have other functions besides just transferring audio and video holdings and conserving film. We don't know the outlines of that because we haven't started the planning process yet. But there's a larger entity in mind that the campus wants to form. Alan, I don't know if you have anything you'd like to add. This is Alan Burdett, who's the director of the ATM. And
I think you said it very well. I mean, the idea is that the university isn't going to pump this much money into preservation if there's not a larger scheme for access and drawing faculty in to use these as research options. So an emerging entity within the library, something called the Research Commons, it remains to be seen what form that will take. The emerging sense is that this will be somehow part of it.
Other questions? Yes, Steve.
Where in this process does the issue of an inventory, item by item, fall?
As in, how do we inventory 560,000 recordings, item by item?
Without an inventory?
Right.
So it seems to me that's the starting place.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question,
and it's
a really tough thing, and I don't have a great answer for that yet. I know from the work I know from the work that I've done that you can prioritize things without having to look at every single item, if you have some experience, and also if you have some documentation from the folks who hold the recordings, and people our collections mostly have documentation with them. So that will allow us to cover collections rather than every single little item. But then there's the issue of cataloging as well. Are you going to catalog on an item-by-item basis? Or are you going to catalog collections? So there's a lot that remains to be figured out. Yeah. George?
There's a lot of work that can happen concurrently. Certainly some number of 560,000 have a high level of bibliographic control.
Yeah.
Yes. And while that's running, then you can do things that need to be surveyed. A lot of information that we need long-term doesn't have to be acquired before digitization. You can do the cataloging after you can play them back and do the discovery, do the description after that.
Absolutely. A percentage of our holdings, I can't remember the number at the moment, but it's in the report, are cataloged using our online public access catalog, which is called IUCAT. If we produce, once you have digital files, then cataloging becomes much easier because you can actually listen to the material.
Yeah, if it's only 5%, you have a 20% window, you've got a whole year running start on the digitization being underway while the survey happens.
Yeah.
So you don't have to do survey all before you run the first paper.
And I should say, the talk of creating a digitization center, we fully expect to outsource some of our materials. There are some formats that I don't expect we will be able to handle, quad being one of them. I mean, who can afford to tool up for quad, really? It's not something I see us doing. But then there may be other strategic decisions around outsourcing, as in you have a run of oral history cassettes that are very easy to do with parallel transfer workflows. That are not really very difficult, maybe outsource those and leave the hard stuff to do in-house where you have a lot of control over it. So these are some of the ideas that we're working with. Other questions?
Another scenario is it provides a very rich environment for training, whether out of the recording school or at the archives, to have the next generation of audiovisual preservation experts, even if they don't have any machines to work with to get done.
Yeah, we have a Department of Recording Arts in the School of Music run by Conrad Strauss, who's here. And so we have access to audio engineers in training. And that is a resource that can certainly help in this effort, help the audio engineers that we hire. Other questions? All right. Oh, well, one more. Yes. The question was, do we see steps towards collaborating with other institutions who have the same problem? Because most of our institutions have this exact same problem, perhaps not to the scale, but we all have it. That's an interesting one. One of the things we'll need to figure out is whether we can offer services to other institutions, whether that makes sense for us. We have so much to do ourselves. You know, can we still get our stuff done and offer services? This is perhaps a revenue stream for us. So we actually have money in the planning process to do business modeling and to see if that actually makes some sense. Yes?
Following on her comment about collaboration, I'm very new to this area of preservation. I work with living artifacts of seeds, but there's many parallels with cold storage and or deterioration slowing down. If you're trying to have commonality, I found on the databases I've tried to use even in archives, there's not a common language. Like, I hope with digitization, as a retired librarian, that we would be able to eventually have quick interface and collaboration, but it doesn't seem that there's a common language. Now, again, forgive me, I may not be expressing this correctly. Is there some kind of, within your association, a standardization kind of format for collections when they're starting to digitize to follow?
There is not a standardized format within our institution. Within this association.
Bigger picture.
Yeah, I don't think so. There's a lot of individual efforts out there. There are some standards in our field. There are some metadata standards, for example, that will help the effort. But this is a significant problem.
How long can you expect digitization to be conserved? Like, if you digitize an object, does it depend on your resolution or how long it'll last?
The question is, does digitization depend on resolution in terms of how long it will last?
Yeah, how long does digitization, how long do you expect, do we think digitization will digitized?
Well, the question really comes into how you store and maintain the file over time. And it's a question of your storage media and also file format obsolescence. And it gets into the world of digital library kinds of work. And in fact, on our campus, we have a digital library program that is squarely responsible for these kinds of issues.
Okay.
It's developing a preservation repository and so forth.
Thank you.
So there's a lot of literature on that out there.
Thank you very much, Michael and Patrick.